All right, so I just got to say, I teach on rest some, and I'm going to do a series on Sunday mornings on rest during Sunday school coming up. And so I have to say that, like, I don't know now, 6 years ago, the first time I taught it, I was talking about human limits, and there's only so far that humans can go. I mean, we don't know what those limits are, but for example, we can't run the 1 second mile. Like, we know we can't, like, that's an actual limit. Human beings can't run a 1 second mile. And so for a long time, they thought they couldn't run a 4 minute mile either. Turns out you can, but there's got to be a place there, right? That you just can't get any faster at some. And I said when I first taught that, I feel like we're seeing that like in the Olympics. We're seeing us near, get come closer and closer to just how much a human body is capable of doing. And I said, so my thought is we're going to start running into narrower and narrower margins of victory over the next few Olympics is what we're going to see. Well, the very next Olympics, after I taught that the first time and after I read that and some stuff, and the very next Olympics, we saw Michael Phelps win a medal by 1/100th of a second, which is a meaningless amount of time for human beings. There's nothing to human, not even the human body does anything in 1/100th of a second. Nerves don't travel through our brain that fast. Lightning strikes take about 4/100ths of a second, for example. And yet somehow, I mean, we're talking about the difference in a certain number of molecules of water between one guy's fingers on the wall and the next guy's fingers on the wall. I mean, you could almost count out how many molecules of water there were between there. And so after that, then the next time I'm teaching it, I'm now using this as an example. And I said, what are we going to do? Because we're going to start seeing ties. And we're going to start seeing people tying at the 1/100th of a second rating. And what are we going to do as a race? How are we going to decide as the human race? What do we do with that? So we're already tying, we're going to be tying at a meaningless amount of time that only until recently have we even had the technology to measure time to that precision. And so what are we going to do when people start tying at 1/100th of a second? Anybody watch the Olympics? There were 4 ties this time around at the 1/100th of a second mark. 1/100th of a second, 4 ties. If I remember correctly, 3 of them were in speed skating and 1 of them was in downhill. In downhill, they don't have the capacity to measure them to the 1/1000th of a second. So we got to watch Bodie Miller, isn't that right? Bodie tie for the bronze. And then, no, there's 2 that were ties because we saw 2 women tie for gold, right? So 2, for the first time ever in modern Olympic history, we've had 2 people in downhill skiing standing on the gold platform because we don't have the capacity out there in the open to measure to the 1/1000th of a second. Not so indoors. Speed skaters, we saw 2 speed skaters this time around not get a medal, check this, by 3/1000ths of a second. This is now an utterly meaningless amount of time. I mean, there is no human way to tell who crossed that line. What they did is tied. By any rational measurement, they tied. Any sane human being would say they tied. But human beings aren't sane. And so we've got to measure. No. So here's what we're doing, and this is going to be fascinating to watch in 2 more years and in 2 more years, is that as a race, we are so obsessed with not resting, with this concept, that we're now going to start parsing out that last second. Because for the most part, we have now gone as fast as humans can go. Now, people go like, people say that every generation somebody blows it away. Yes, but when they're blowing it away now, they're blowing it away by pieces of a second. People don't even win by a second or 2 seconds or 4 seconds. The world record is now being parsed, tiny, tiny, tiny parts. It's going to watch this. And the problem is, the church, we're just competing with this. We're going, oh yeah, you're busy? Watch how busy we can be. We can do everything you can do and church. We can do everything you can do and add in more stuff. Your children are playing an instrument, ours are playing 2 instruments. Your kids are studying a language, ours are studying 2 languages. And one of them is Latin. And on top of that, our children go to Sunday school and church and life group and Wednesday night and all these other activities. And so, in addition to everything the world is doing, what we're offering is just more busy. this concept of saying, I am, we're more, and that's now our answer. Doesn't it feel awful if someone says, can you imagine anyone nowadays saying that? If somebody going up, how's your life? And you're going like, I don't know what to do with all the time. I mean, I just kind of chill out a bunch. And I mean, people are like, well, that's immoral. That's just bad. That's wrong, right? And yet, so here's a mindset. When the church is just competing at the world's way of doing things, we now don't have anything to offer. So we have this eternal perspective. What the world needs is to rest, and we have a concept of that they lack. This is why no one is listening to us about marriage. Same exact concept. The world looks at our marriages and says, clearly, you have nothing to teach us. I mean, to me, it must look hilarious. I mean, bordering on absurd when Christians are running around trying to teach everybody else what marriage is supposed to look like. Oh, no, marriage is supposed to look like this. If I was a secular person, if I was in the world, I would say, right, I'm going to listen to you people about marriage. Because the truth is, our marriages are just as dismal a failure as most of theirs are. I don't know that this is true, and I don't mean this judgmentally, but when I stand up there and preach, I assume 80 to 85% of the marriages in the room are failures. I presume that 80 to 85% of the marriages are not a good living parable of God's love for his people. And here's what's wild. So God gives us this gift of sex, and it's so poetically presented in the Bible, isn't it? I mean, over the top, naked and unashamed. There's your first reference in the Bible. I always tell everybody that's my life verse. When people are like, what's your life verse? I'm always like, Genesis 2:25, man. They were naked and unashamed. This is, by the way, why my wife doesn't sit on the front while I'm teaching on sex. I'm impressed you're halfway. Usually she's like in the back, ready to escape. She's a little bit of my barometer that I glance over at her every once in a while. And she's got this windblown look. Then I know I may have crossed a boundary there. But because I'm a therapist, I don't know what is appropriate for public conversation, which is fine. That's why I could talk about this, I guess. but so the picture that I think, and one of the places where Christian marriages are awful is in regards to sex. Our marriages are typically just terrible about this, which is so wild because we allegedly have learned from the Creator about it. So the guy who came up with the concept of sexuality and who is the one who has expressed it to us and who has expressed to us this general picture of marriage being a living parable of God's love for his people. And God's love for his people is defined by sacrifice. And he's given us one picture of this after another. We aren't getting it. And so what's happening is we're trying to engage with the erotic world. And so Christian women are out reading 50 Shades of Grey and saying, I'm going to read this and get turned on and take that to my marriage bed because that creates it. And the problem is illicit and intimate don't play together. And it doesn't work. And if you can read about a friend of mine who lives here in town, Shannon Etheridge, has written a number of books about this. And she's another therapist, so she's not for the faint of heart. You read her stuff, she's not embarrassed to talk about whatever. But she has a book called The Fantasy Fallacy, and she explains it don't work. Because you can't take what the world is saying, hey, this is what sex is all about, and say, now I'm going to bring that into my Christian marriage bed. Because it fails. They don't mix. Methamphetamine and a 5-course meal don't mix. A fine meal at a restaurant and the high that comes, the flash fire from here, you don't build a bonfire in the fireplace in your wedding, in your marriage bed, in your bedroom. You have a fireplace in your bedroom, you don't build a bonfire there because it's not the type of fire that is that. That's what the world has to offer. And that's, by the way, pretty much all the world has to offer is the addictive, shameful, hot and heavy, but lethal expression of sexuality. And the church is going, oh yeah? We can figure that out too. And guess what? We're not gonna. And if you do, our marriages are going to fail at just the same rate, and our sex lives are going to be just as miserable as theirs. I'm telling you, theirs are miserable. And for the most part, they're a train wreck too. The problem is, of course, in the world, you would expect their marriages, you would expect their sexual expression to be a train wreck. That doesn't explain why ours are. I think in the vast majority of our Christian marriages, sex is the main source of conflict, hurt, pain, rejection, frustration, all of that, which is clearly not what God intended. When you read in Scripture in 1 Corinthians 7 of God saying, no, no, this is a bonding agent for the marriage. This is supposed to be what holds you together and brings you together. In fact, the only reason why it wouldn't be a normal, healthy part of a marriage is if you're intentionally fasting to pray to really focus your attention on God for a short period of time. And so the idea that we would go, well, I mean, in our marriage, we've been apparently fasting and praying for a long time. We're missing something if that's, and the problem is very often, even when there is sexual engagement, I'm going to explain how I think this happens. When there is a sexual engagement between a husband and a wife, it still just feels like death for at least one of them. It still just feels like wages for at least one of them. I think in most of the Christian marriages that I interact with, for at least one of them, having sex is about avoiding the negative emotional consequences of not having sex. And that's what it becomes. Well, I better. And the problem is this has been propagated in the church, at least for all of my lifetime. And I think it's a load. I mean, I think it is just excrement. And it is so sad to me to see it. And I hear it constantly, book after book, even in the Christian world. Again, I expect the world's publications to be just trash about this. I'm so heartbroken every time that the church's publications about this are just as lost and confused and ridiculous. So I want to start with one of the main teachings that the church has accidentally, and by the church I don't mean a capital C, I mean our representation, I mean us, not God, that have accidentally foisted on us, is this idea, all men want is sex. That has been taught and propagated and backed, and unfortunately, it's a lie that fits in real naturally with how women engage with sex. But there's absolutely, you will know, there's no research to back that, and there's a ton of research to fight it. It's just not the case. Some of the men in the room are going like, really, it is? When I explain it in a second, you will go, you know what, that's exactly right. I feel confident of that. I've done it enough times now that I feel like that's going to be the case in a minute. And I'm just going to go until I run out of time, and then I'll pick up next week. I may end at an awful time today, because wherever I am at 7:30, we'll be done, and we'll pick up there next time. But I was taught that. So if you can imagine, at Mount Lebanon Baptist Encampment, 16, 17 years old, 3,000 students, and the guy gets up on stage, and here's what I remember that he taught. It was Wednesday night, and on Wednesday night at youth camp, you always talk about sex. How far is too far? Because that's the only thing you teach teenagers about sex. which is just so sad, and it's done this way. So here's the conversation that's had. Girl, I remember this. It's unreal that I can remember this so vividly. Ladies, you need to watch out for the guys. Because guys, here's the quote, guys will play at love, which they don't understand, in order to get sex, which is what they really want. And girls, you're playing at sex, which you don't understand, in order to get love, which is what you really want. Well, that's all you need to know about sex, isn't it? Men are animals in heat, and girls are these pure little creatures who are supposed to fight them off. There you go. Now you know all you need to know about sex. Is it any wonder that couples then get married, and she is still asking herself 20 years later, does he want me or does he want sex? Which, by the way, is almost a universal question for you ladies. And I'll explain why that happens in a second. I got on to trying to answer this and figure out what's going on or how have we broken this so badly a couple of different ways. One was the question of why, when couples live together first, why doesn't it automatically mean they have a much higher success rate of marriage? Because the exact opposite is true. The one that, though, that really got me was the first day that I had a woman come in to counseling and say, you know, I wish my husband would touch me more non-sexually. And being a good therapist, I said, all right, interesting. Well, tell me more about that. And in my head, I was thinking, what is she talking about? What does she mean? Now, I'm not stupid. It didn't take but a few seconds to realize she meant the parts of her body covered by underwear. But let me just tell you, there's not a man in the room who divides out touch that way. None of us intuitively divide out touch between sexual touch and non-sexual touch with our wives. We don't think like, okay, do I want to touch my wife sexually or do I want to touch my wife non-sexually? It doesn't even cross my mind to think that way. Because I integrate that into every aspect of my identity. And By the way, ladies, you don't, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But that's a, that began to, I began to go, wait, what? Here's the second question. So a book came out, a Christian book came out years ago, and I'm not going to reference it. I think the author is a good man. I just think he was misguided in regards to this. There's no research to back his book, and it's always bad strategy. And so he comes out and writes this book about what the things that men need in marriage and what are the things that women need in marriage. Some of you probably read this book, How to Affair-Proof Your Marriage, which I already knew I didn't like that concept, as if it's my job to keep my wife from having an affair. Wrong. It is my job to keep me from having an affair. That's between me and God. My faithfulness is about my character, nothing to do with my wife's. Her faithfulness is about hers, between her and God, has nothing to do with me. Now, there are ways, obviously, we play that it can be symptoms of problems, but it's not my job to keep my wife from having an affair, and it's not her job to keep me from having one. That's just, what an awful way to start. What a works-based marriage you've just created. But, so do anybody remember, anybody read this book? What was man's number one need? You can probably guess. Sex, right? And remember what man's number two need was? And no one ever remembers it. Yeah, more sex. No. The number two need was domestic support, okay? So I had this somewhat cynical, granted, somewhat cynical client come in after reading that book and say, so in other words, my husband wants a prostitute who cleans his house? Now, your brain doesn't work like my brain does, which is a very good thing for most of humanity. My brain immediately said, why don't I have a prostitute who cleans my house? In fact, why don't anybody have a prostitute who cleans their house? Think of how much easier it would be to have a prostitute who cleaned your house. Think of how much cheaper it would be to have a prostitute who cleaned your house. How much less complicated it would be. I mean, if things didn't go well, you could just fire her and hire another one. I mean, the benefits are just off the charts, right? Then why don't any of us have that? Because that's not what we want. That's why. Because I'm telling you, we could. As men, if we decide to do it's not a moral issue. Hugh Hefner even marries those girls. It's not about having a prostitute to clean your house. That's actually not what men want, and men actually find that repugnant, the research says. Then how have we bought into this idea that what men really want is sex? Because it's a crock. I'm going to explain it. Then I'll tell you one more story from the Bible. The story of Esther is a beautiful story in the Bible, but not for the reason that most people think. It's not a romantic story. There's nothing romantic about this. We're dealing with a guy named Xerxes, probably. It's hard to tell because they give him the Hebrew name in Esther. Artaxerxes or something like that. But Xerxes, we think, is who it was. And Xerxes was a man who considered himself God on earth. I absolutely in no way recommend the movie 300, but if you've seen it, you probably, and just right now they're doing previews of the next one of it, so you've seen the previews. Okay, the crazy giant-looking dude with the big gold axe and gold hanging all over his body, that's the presentation in that movie of Xerxes. Xerxes did not look like that. He was not 17 feet tall, hairless, with gold hanging all over his body. But that's probably how Xerxes thought of himself. So when Xerxes marches 2 million men against the Greeks, he's the one who faced the Spartans. He marches about 2 million men. To this day, possibly the largest army to march across the face of the earth. This is 500 years before Jesus. And he marches these men against the Greeks. He faces the 300 Spartans that are so famous, plus another about 4,000 Greek soldiers at Thermopylae. As he's marching his 2 million soldiers, and by the way, the reason he's doing this is because the Greeks insulted his father. That's why he marches 2 million men across a continent to wipe out a race. Now, he loses, but that's his goal. He comes to the Hellespont River, and he puts down bridges. His men put down bridges so they can cross the Hellespont River with 2 million men. As the first men are crossing, a storm comes in, washes away the bridge, and kills thousands of his men. So Xerxes has the Hellespont River beaten. I mean, he lines the shore with men with whips and sticks, and they beat the Hellespont River to teach it a lesson. You don't cross Xerxes. Then they throw in handcuffs and chains and locks all along the river to make sure the river doesn't make the mistake of getting too high and mighty and knocking over his bridges again. This guy's a brick short of a load. This is the man in Esther's story. So again, if you picture him as some sweet little Prince Caspian, like the movies, the Christian movies always present him, Don't. Nothing sweet about this guy. So he gets mad because Vashti won't probably strip for he and his friends. The word is dance, but that's probably a euphemism. Strip for he and his friends. It's his number one queen. So she's so high and mighty, he fires her. And is always, by the way, he was always a lookout for new queens. Again, we have this picture of, well, now there's an opening. So that's how Esther got her job. No. So women, there were thousands of women always in his harem, and they were being trained for a year before they get their one night with him. So Esther gets her one night with Xerxes and so impresses him that he makes her a queen the next day. If you're picturing a coronation and a wedding, don't. You should probably imagine that's a means she gets her own room, maybe some servants. It's so romantic that he has nothing to do with her for a month and barely recognizes her when she shows up at his door a month later. That's probably because there had been 28 more women, a new one each night, being trained for a year to spend one night with him, probably. So he sees her, he likes her. So he then goes to her. She shows up and says, hey, let's do a banquet. He comes to her chambers, just he and Haman. She and her servants serve this great banquet. And this is Persia. You've got to picture a Persian, a woman in all of the, like you picture, what's her name in her, from Aladdin, right? I mean, so sheer clothing, low-cut stuff. This is how the women dressed for their men in that part of the world at this time. And so it was very, very, would have been probably very seductive, probably very romantic and very, like, kind of over the top. At the end of that evening, Xerxes, God on earth, in his own opinion, says, you know what, I'll give you anything you want. And what does she say? Remember? What does she say the first night? Come back tomorrow night. This is a tease, right? Hey, come back tomorrow night, big boy. See what I've got for you then, right? That's probably what's going on here. If all men wanted was sex, and you have Xerxes, for whom Esther is property, she is his sexual property. How does that evening end? Hey, come back tomorrow night. And Xerxes says, other plans. Haman, take a hike, right? But he doesn't. Why? I'm convinced it's because Xerxes is fascinated by the idea of a woman who seems to freely desire him. And that's what men actually want. What men really want is the feeling of being freely desired by a woman and having a woman in his life who wants to be freely desired by him. A woman who wants him and who wants to be wanted by him. That's what the research actually backs. Anybody read Feldman's books, For Men Only, For Women Only? You get these amazing, she actually did research. I know that that's a little bit novel for Christian publishing, but she actually did research before she wrote her book. And in her book, one of the things she says is, she asked the question of something like 3,000 men. I think that's right. She asked the question, if you knew that your wife would be available for you for sex at any time you wanted, any time, but she was never going to be into it, would you be satisfied with that sex life? How many men do you think answered yes to that? Hey, as long as she's willing to put out, I'll be happy. How many men do you think were satisfied with that? 3%. You realize 3% represents the sociopaths and the narcissists alone. They each represent about 1.5% of our population, diagnosably sociopathic or diagnosably narcissistic. In other words, sane men aren't satisfied with that. That flies in the face of everything we've been told by Hollywood, everything we've been told by television, everything we've been told by the media, and even a lot of what we've been told in the church. It flies in the face of that. No wonder for so long women have been so offended by this. I want to tell a story, and hopefully we'll get at least most of the way through the story. Now, I always have to preface this story with this. This is not a story about me and Ginger. I didn't used to preface it that way, and one day Ginger said, you know everybody thinks you're telling a story about us. And I was like, no, they don't. They know it's not about us. And then so the next time I taught, I said, how many of you thought that that story was about Ginger and I, every single person in the room raised their hand. And so I now preface by saying, this is not a story about Ginger and I. Although, in private, we would both tell you, we certainly had our moments like this. This misunderstanding was a crippling of impact in our marriage for a while, too. And no one solves this because our intuitions are different. But with an understanding, this concept, marriage is a living parable of God's love for his people. God's love for his people is best defined by the moment of Jesus on the cross. Sacrifice is a necessary, required aspect of marriage. In order for it to be what God intends it to be, there must be opportunities to sacrifice. I don't know if that's what God finds offensive about homosexual relationships or not. God doesn't reveal that to us. It may be that part of the problem with homosexual relationships are there's not as many opportunities to sacrifice. And God loves for us to have a good time in marriage. He loves for us to enjoy marriage as a good gift. He loves all of that stuff. But his priority is for us to have the opportunity to sacrifice. When I do a wedding, and I've got a few lined up, which is really fun, but when I do a wedding, I always comment on this statement. Some of you who have been married for a while have caught on to the fact that marriage is an awful way to get your needs and wants met. Anybody been married long enough to catch on to the fact that marriage is an awful way to get your needs and wants met? Good. It's, in fact, what marriage is really excellent for is giving you the opportunity to sacrifice your needs and wants for somebody else for the rest of your life. It seems to be really good at that. Does it? You notice that? It gives you lots of opportunities to sacrifice what you need and want for somebody else's needs and wants. It's almost like it was designed to do that. And I would say that's exactly what it was designed to do. To be a lifelong, living parable of God's love for his people. And God isn't wandering around all the time going, yeah, well, what have you done for me lately? God is wandering around saying, I have poured out everything. With great joy, I sold it all for you. That's why we have that Ephesians 5 passage that is so powerful to me. I think Ephesians 5 teaches. Ephesians 5 is when Paul talks about marriage. Wives, I know the Greek word there, hupotasso, submit. The problem is the English connotation of the word submit has changed in a long time. Now most, especially women, when you hear the word submit, they think capitulate. And that's not hupotasso. Hupotasso is not a capitulation word. It is an active word. And so probably nowadays I'm wondering if we shouldn't start using the word devote there. Wives, devote yourself to the husband as to the Lord. Now submit's the right word, but I feel like we've messed up the word submit so bad that now maybe we need to start using other words in there. But wives, submit, devote yourselves to your husbands as to the Lord. Now, so that's the if-then statement. Husbands, love your wife as Christ loves the church and gave himself up for her, sacrificed for her. So you have this great little trade-off. Husbands are like, in the relationship of Christ and the church, husbands are like what? Christ. And wives are like the church. This is an analogy that Paul creates. Here's what's so powerful to me about this passage. And this, some of this is a little new to me. I've said for years there's an if-then statement implied. If blank, then I love my wife. What is the if-then statement Paul creates? If what? If Christ loves the church, comma, then I love my wife. Paul intentionally takes my wife out of this equation for me. It doesn't say, husbands, love your wives as she submits to you. He says, here's the standard. The standard is you love your wives as Christ loved the church. And, by the way, gave himself up for her. Now, if that's the case, then reverse it. When I don't love my wife, what is my testimony and proclamation to the world? Christ doesn't love the church. I think this is part of why we have become irrelevant in our culture, is because our marriages stink. And people look at our marriages and say, if that's the relationship, and maybe they do it intuitively, I'm not saying they get the depth of this, But maybe they go, listen, if these Christian folks can't even get their marriage right, why would I look to them for anything else? Wives, if you don't devote yourselves to your husbands, what are you proclaiming? The church is not devoted to Christ. That's the message. And so I have to recognize, I get up and preach on a Sunday morning, and this is, you've all experienced this. I get up and preach on Sunday morning, and as we're putting our kids, we've got like 40 of them, and as we're putting them in the van on the way out there, if you walk by, and you hear me snap at Ginger about something in that moment, what just happened to my sermon? Right? Forget it. And that's totally appropriate. Now, you're looking to the God's Word, not me, when I preach, hopefully. But my role in it, absolutely, it should be. That's exactly the right attitude, I think. Because I've just proclaimed, hey, no matter what I said on stage, the truth is I don't really think Christ loves the church. This is a big deal for us. When it comes to sex in our marriages, we must understand our spouses. We have to come at it from a perspective of understanding. Otherwise, we just create trauma on top of trauma, which I think is what's happened in most of our marriages. So let me tell you the story. Once there was a couple, and by the way, I'm going to simplify this. I could make this so complex, I'll show you some places where I could. So a young couple gets married. They are sexually inexperienced, okay? I could already complicate matters right now by saying they both have tons of sexual experience in their past, all types of trauma of different ways. It would just magnify everything I'm going to say, okay? So let's make it where the couple is sexually inexperienced, and they get married. And he goes away for the weekend. He's got to go work on business. At this stage, because she's sexually inexperienced, she still sees sexuality as something novel, as like a kid who's got a new Christmas present, you know. It's not boring yet or anything like that. It's just kind of intriguing on its own merits. She, at this stage, is intrigued by the effect she can have on her husband and his body. That's still fascinating to her. Like, look at that. I mean, that's just, her whole mindset is like, this is so fascinating to me that I can affect him this way. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think we see that in Esther, in Ruth, and in Song of Solomon, the three kind of sexual narratives that we have. And so this is still a novel to her. It's still novel to him. So he goes away, and she says, you know what, I'm gonna rock his world when he gets home. I'm going to seduce my husband when he gets home. So she does, you know, she buys something slinky. She does rose petals to the bed. I mean, you know, whatever. And he comes home, and he finds his rose petals leading him to the bedroom, and she's in something slinky, and she seduces him. She welcomes him into her bed and seduces him with all that she's got, okay? Now, I'm going to stop there for a second. My therapists at my office say that men have two emotions, angry and not angry, okay? And I always say, you're leaving out hungry and sleepy, right? There's more, much more. So typically, the reason of that is, as men, we are radically unsophisticated about our feelings. We have all the same feelings that women do. We just have not been trained by anyone on how to even begin to talk about them. So we're in many ways, when it comes to talking about emotions, men are like children, meaning ignorant and untrained. But I want to show you something. And this is part of why it's so dangerous for men to express their emotions. I'm about to show you. Men, she has just welcomed him into her bed. He has been seduced by her and welcomed there. How does that feel? I know there's a number of men here, but you can do it. It's much harder when there's women in the room too, but you can do it. How does it feel? Good. Okay. That's a good start. What else? You can do better than that. Very good. Really good. Excellent. What else? Safe. What's that? Desired. Empowered. After. We're talking about after he's been engaged by her, right? Yeah. By the stage some of the marriages are at, I mean, what's funny, when I do this sometimes, the man is like confused as to where my wife is. Like, who are you and what have you done with my wife? So that can be the case. But put it in there. What's it like at that stage, right? Early on, like that. What else? Excited. Absolutely. Who said that? Oh, John. Right, there's one. Home. A lot of times when I have, you've probably heard me say that, right? Have you heard me? Okay. A lot of times, what are some others before I get off on that? How does he feel? Come on. Safe? Satisfied? Accepted? Loved? Honored? Was that a girl's voice? Here's what's wild. A lot of times we'll go through this, and guys will be throwing out these words, accepted, wanted, loved. And a lot of times women in the room are going, we're just talking about sex, right? All that? Based on that? That's one of the reasons for men we have a hard time communicating our emotions is because women don't intuitively have the same emotions about the same thing. And we feel real stupid when we feel something that our wife isn't intuitively going to feel at the same time. We feel dumb about that. So we're hesitant to share that because she may go, what? And we know you're better at emotions than we are. And so, we already feel like whatever we feel must be stupid. Well, most men feel that most of the time. Whatever I'm feeling, it's got to be stupid. And I'm not going to tell anybody. That's why we use anger as an anesthetic for what we really feel. Now, both genders do that. But we feel hurt or pain or scared or embarrassed, and what we do is express anger because we're fragile and unsophisticated about emotions. We bang our head on the cabinet, and we don't say, ow, that really hurt. Would someone hug me? That would be the rational thing to say because what you're experiencing is pain. Instead, what we say is, who left the freaking cabinet door open? Which makes no sense because you have no reason to be angry. Anger is a ridiculous response to being hurt. But there you are. But men have all these powerful emotions, wanted and loved and accepted and safe and warm and home. A lot of times, even with someone who's not already heard my teaching on this and throws that word out, about half the time in the audience, a lot of times men will throw out that word. As they're trying to explain what they feel, they'll go, home. What's funny to me is I thought that was just me. I wrote a poem to Ginger long ago called Home. Because I thought that was just, I felt that way and I didn't know how to express it. And it's been wild to me to say in a group of men, how do you feel? Especially when it's just men, it's amazing how often I will get that. I feel like I'm welcomed, I'm wanted, like I'm home. Me, I am wanted, I am welcomed. It's a very powerful thing. I think this is because men integrate sexuality into our identity. It's part of who and what we are. I think this borders on universal. I don't know if it's universal, but so far in my experience, it's been very, very, very common that we integrate sexuality into our identity. We have never wondered whether our wife wanted us or wanted sex. No man's ever thought that. So when this guy comes home and he gets, you know, he gets welcomed in this way, he gets welcomed into his wife's bed freely, safely, with freedom and adventure and grace and all of that. I never have men go, used. I've never had that happen, right? Suspicious. I'm not sure if she wants me or just wants my body. You know why? Because if you pursue a man sexually, you're pursuing him. That's how we intuitively understand it. And I think, by the way, that's how it probably was for both genders in the garden. I think probably before the fall, sex was integrated into their identities. That's why they were naked and unashamed. See, when something's integrated into your identity, you need a reason to not do it. You follow me? You need a reason to not do it. You don't need a reason to. You have a reason to. It's part of your identity. You would need a reason not to. Now do you understand why your husband touches you sexually when there's not a good reason not to? I watch few of you cop a feel at church. It's really rare. I almost never see it. Why? Because there's a reason not to, right? At church, it's not acceptable. Unless you really think you can get away with it, you're not going to do that, right? But for a man for whom that is integrated into his identity, typically, there's not a reason not to in your bedroom. Why wouldn't you? He's just as confused about the fact that you don't touch him sexually, to use your terminology, all the time, as you are that he's always touching you sexually. See, because he doesn't divide those out. They're integrated for him. He would need a reason to not engage sexually. And so there would be rare reasons not to. You're married. It's not sin. It's a beautiful thing before God. It burns calories. It's fun. It's free. Like there's not a good reason not to. Here's the problem, men. So one, ladies, you need to hear that. You need to hear that I am convinced that intuitively, your husband has never thought, I don't want my wife, I just want sex. It's never crossed his mind to think that way. He doesn't divide them out. If he's pursuing you sexually, I am convinced that intuitively what the man is doing is pursuing you. The more I engage with men on this topic, the more this concept is backed by them. The more I hear about it. And the more research is done by people like Feldon, the more you discover that this is the case. That this is how men think of it. That we integrate it into our identity. It's part of who we are. When my wife pursues me sexually, it feels like she wants me. I don't divide that out in any way. And that's important because so many of you women, for you, your sexuality is like a stake that you carry around with you that draws dogs. That's how it feels to you. Is it, well, he's not after, they're just after something from me. It's not me they want, it's something from me. The reason that makes sense to you is because I have become more and more convinced that women don't integrate sexuality into their identity. I want to stop and take a second and comment on frequency. Very often after I've done teaching about this, people will bring up the question of like, okay, what you said is this way, but what if the wife wants sex more often than the husband? That's a question of frequency. That's almost exclusively an issue of drive and threshold. That's actually not what I'm talking about. So you will know, even though it's presented as though 100% of the time the man wants sex more often than the woman, the truth is that's only about a 70-30. About 30% of the time in a marriage, the woman wants to engage sexually more often than the man. And by the way, that's probably true even in regards to healthy things. There can be unhealthy reasons. The man may not want to engage in sex because he has a masturbation problem or a pornography problem or something like that. That may be part of it. but even in regards to healthy men and women, it's probably about 70-30. That's about frequency. That's about testosterone levels. That's about exhaustion levels. That's about depression. That's about anxiety. That's about all kinds of other things that really aren't what I'm talking about. I'm really talking about what sex means. And to be able to set you free in this regard, some of you women have been married a long time, and you've been under depression almost that entire time that your husband wanted something from you and didn't want you. And so you will know, with the exception of about 3% of the population, men don't think that way. We don't divide. I'm not convinced that most men can think that way. It's part of what makes marriages fail is that men can't get into the mindset of their wives, which is to divide out identity from sexuality, which is to say, I'm even in competition with my own sexuality. And women think men divide it out. They think that men are making that statement. Do I want my wife or do I want sex? I don't know. I'll go with sex. It doesn't happen. When I teach to MOPS, mothers of preschoolers, this is now all they want me to teach about. I go from MOPS group to MOPS group to MOPS group teaching on sex. In fact, people are so hungry for any type of teaching on this. This weekend I'm doing a conference for a young married Sunday school class down in South Texas. Guess what they want me to teach on? That will be my fourth time in 7 days to teach on sex. That's how much people in the church are going, would someone help us with this? Would someone talk to us about this in a way that might make some sense? So she divides them out, which I think is natural. So one of those things I tell MOPS groups is, and this is, I think, literally how divided out. This is why women ask that question. I wish my husband would touch me more non-sexually. I guess my husband just wants a prostitute who cleans the house, etc. This idea is because it's divided out. And if it's, guys, listen to this. If it's divided out, you need a reason to do it. You don't need a reason not to. You need a reason to. And so when it's divided out like that, you need a reason to bring it together. And so that's part of what's going on in our marriages is we're going, well, why not? And she's going, why? Because they're two very different things. My wife naturally nests. That's built into her identity. She's a nester. My wife buys baby clothes when we don't have babies. We've got baby clothes, and I'll be like, you know, we don't have any babies. I know, but someone, and maybe, and like, that's part of her identity. It is built into her. That's common. It's not as universal as this, I think, but it's pretty common for nesting and mothering to be integrated into a woman's identity. And so Shanti Felden says, ladies, you need to know something. When you say no to your husband sexually, you're saying no to him. That's what he's experiencing. You need to be aware of that. If you're going to sacrifice for your husband, you need to be aware of that. That doesn't mean you have to always say yes. That's not the conclusion for that. And I will tell you, men, it is time for us as men to learn that being disappointed is okay. We're big boys. It's okay to be disappointed. It's okay. But the problem is, if we don't have this conversation, we feel rejected. That's where we'll start next time, is with that part of the story. So women divide that out. To the degree that when I do this, a lot of times this is something that women, MOPS especially, they will all start laughing and I can't get their attention back sometimes. I think here's intuitively often how women engage with this. I think that a lot of women think that men wake up and say, I'd like to touch some breasts today. I'm not going to look at my wife for this part. Where could I find some breasts? My wife has breasts. Here's what's wild. Men don't think that way. When a man is touching his wife, he thinks he's touching his wife. He doesn't think he's touching a part of her body. He thinks he's touching his wife. That's intuitively, I think, how men do. We don't think, oh, I want to touch this part of a body. But women who divide that out in their identity, they experience that. They experience, if all you're doing, ever doing, is touching what she would consider the sexual parts of her body, what she experiences is me versus those parts of my body. She thinks that's happening. Here's what's wild. Men, we've got to get into our heads this, that. Intuitively, most of the women in our lives, if you touch her breasts, she thinks you're touching breasts. That's what she thinks. She doesn't think you're touching her. Now, listen, from a man's perspective, that's nuts. If my wife were to touch me sexually, I don't go, I intuitively experience is, that's me she's touching. And on top of that, she's the only one allowed to touch me like that. It's that much more special, right? That's intuitively, guys, I'm telling you, I think that's intuitive. Women, I think that's intuitively how men engage with it. I think most of the men in the room, when I teach this, I think most shocked audience is the men going, she doesn't think of it like this. All those times that I was pursuing her sexually, she was wondering, wait, does he want me or does he just want something? And so next time I will talk some more about this, but for us to learn, as men especially, to lead our wives back to a place, a safe place that it becomes healthy for them to bring that back together, safe for them to bring that back together, so that we as men declare war on this mindset that the whole rest of the world is teaching her, which is you're something to be used. You're a performance-based piece of equipment. That's where we get the language that we do. A piece? How offensive is that? And should be. Sex is not an it. It's not some. It's not any. It's her. And that's as men, as we begin to communicate to her that truth, which, by the way, ladies, is how we've always thought of it intuitively. That's the natural way we think of it, is we're thinking about having her and being had by her. That's intuitively what we didn't know that you divided those out. It makes total sense at the end. And so I'll give you the rest of the story next time, but just real quick, I want you to see this, how this plays out, how awful, what a train wreck this is for most of our marriages. So you fight all day. I mean, you just have an awful day. You're on each other's nerves all day, picking at each other. It's just a rotten day. And at the end of the day, he wants to make love. What? I mean, isn't that all the proof you need? He doesn't even like me, but he wants to have sex. That's all the proof you need. Chris, come on. He wants sex, not me. He doesn't like me or want me. It's something he just wants to get off. Guess what? That makes total sense from the perspective of a person whose identity and sexuality is divided out. But check this out. What if your identity and sexuality are integrated? What's happening at the end of that day? What is he trying to do? Restore. Reconnect. He wants to fully be had by you and for you to fully have him. That's what he's trying to accomplish. Notice how the very same thing from the two different perspectives, he's then confused, right? That's why he's so confused when you go, what, are you crazy? We've been fighting all day. He's going, right, exactly. That's my point. And she's going, see, I knew it. You're just some kind of a lech. You just want a piece. It's not, this isn't about me. This is about some for you. And you're going, and the guy's going, how do I respond to that? I don't know what to say. Like, no. But, and so we'll continue with the story there next time. My goal in this is, Ginger read a book called Hava not long ago. And she came away from that book with this fascinating kind of terminology where she said, what would it be like to try to reclaim the garden? What would that be like? Listen, Jesus coming and giving us the Spirit is better than the garden. So how come our marriages stink? How come our sex life is so bad? Because we're not listening. We're not sacrificing. We're not knowing our spouse well enough. So just to encourage you, that's where we're going, and we will finish up with that next time. But I hope even already there's been some insight that you've thought, well, dang. Let me tell you, the first time I understood this, began to understand this, men, let me just tell you, the first thing I had to do was to go to my wife and repent and say, I'm sorry. I have pouted, and I have been irritable, and I've been a pain, and the whole time it's because I didn't understand. And it's not like we're now flawless. We're intuitively different, so our wires get crossed at times. But now we can talk about that. She can give me the benefit of the doubt, and I can give her the benefit of the doubt. And there's grace and freedom in that. And that's my prayer for all of us. So let me pray that. Father, I thank you so much for the gift of sex. I am so sorry before you that we have so twisted it in our culture, that it now runs rampant in the streets. And I am sure, Lord, that just like the Mesopotamians and the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Romans before us, that it will bring down our culture. Sex is so powerful, you put it inside of an institution called marriage. It's such an important thing that like fire, it gives life, and so you put it in it. You created a special stone box called marriage, so that it could give us life without taking our lives. Just like a fireplace. And God, you so knew what you were doing, and we so have botched it. So God, my prayer is that this week already there may could be some communication, some conversations of, I'm so sorry I've misunderstood you. That ladies would be able to say to her husband, I'm so sorry that I have filed you away in my brain as some kind of animal in heat who doesn't really love me and just wants something from me. How could I have come to that conclusion about you? That as men we would learn to say, I'm so sorry that I have been so insensitive, that I have told you over and over and over again without knowing it, that I choose sex over you. God, I pray you would set us free of this empty way of life given to us by our culture. And that we instead would rise up with powerful marriages where sex is a beautiful and lasting flame that could make a difference in our culture too and could tell the world, this is how Jesus loves you. It looks like this. Watch us. God, I pray that for our church and for every church in Tyler and for every church in the country, that we would come to a place where our marriages are living parables and people want to know about your son because of our marriages. And I ask that you would accomplish that in our midst. In his name, amen.